From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2013 when a Dutch news website called De Correspondent officially launched. The site set a goal of providing great journalism and, in their words, an antidote to the daily news grind. Within weeks, De Correspondent had raised more than €1 million by crowdfunding. 5 years later, tens of thousands of members pay the equivalent of around $60 per year to support the journalists doing the work. Is this the model to save print journalism? Here in Rochester, current and former journalists have been meeting for years, sometimes over coffee, sometimes over a drink or six, trying to figure out how to save print journalism in Western New York. Could they create their own newspaper? Would it have to be digital only? Would anyone be willing to pay for it? These are important but legitimately frightening questions for journalists, and that's why it's interesting to see a new Rochester-based journalistic enterprise launching, taking a cue of sorts from De Correspondent, but also willing to do some things differently. It's called the Rochester Beacon. The people behind the Beacon describe a goal of offering journalism that, in their words, strives for relevance, diversity, and depth versus random facts, stereotypes, and cliches. So let's find out what they're up to. My guests from the Rochester Beacon include the publisher, Alex Zapisoshny. Alex, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having us here.
Also with us is Paul Erickson, editor-in-chief. Paul, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
The managing editor is Smriti Jacob. Smriti, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Kent Gardner is opinion editor because he has nothing else to do. Kent, welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Evan.
This is a group of folks who obviously has a lot of other things going on in this community, but Alex, as the publisher, I'll start with you. How did this come together? Paul has written a little bit and reading on the site that maybe a year and a half ago, people started meeting and talking about this. But when did they rope you in? And tell me your recollections of those conversations.
They roped me in. Well, that sounds bad. I really wanted to be part of it starting about a year ago when we started meeting, because I certainly agreed that this community, just like pretty much every community in the country, could certainly use more quality local journalism. And so from my perspective, the idea of looking at the opportunities that we actually have, being a digital-only publication, trying to rethink the business model behind how a local newspaper can be focused, from my perspective, that was a very exciting opportunity to become involved.
Okay. Paul, who is mostly responsible for this thing happening? Who's the first person who drummed up the idea?
Well, I guess I was.
That's why I turned to you.
It really came, it was, as Alex said, started in earnest back about a year ago, a little bit earlier than that. I had been for 30 years at the Rochester Business Journal, and after departing there, I just started getting together with some of the people that I had worked with there, some of the people I admired most, respected most, and just thinking about different opportunities for myself. But part of the conversation was, what if? What if we got together and worked on something and did the kind of journalism that we all wanted to do and often at the Business Journal weren't able to do because of the pressures of the business and what if we did that? And everybody I talked to was really eager and excited about the idea. So that's really where the conversation started.
I want to make it clear, too, that even though journalists, probably in just about every American city where they're really worried about the future of journalism and print journalism, and I'm calling this print, by the way, because even though it's digital only, it's the written word. So in my world, it's sort of a version of print, which is often where the assumption of where print publications like newspapers are going anyway. It's very possible. But there's probably conversations, Paul, in every city with journalists saying, what are we going to do here? I mean, there's more staff cuts coming. I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that the Democrat and Chronicle is going away tomorrow, and thank goodness it's not. I mean, I've got great friends and the colleagues over there doing great work. But I wonder if you look at the landscape, not just here, but around the country in other cities where print publications are going from 7 days to 3 days run or digital only, cutting staff. And are you thinking, we should be ahead of that because who knows what's coming on that?
Well, and one thing I want to make clear is we all feel that we have a lot of respect for the other journalists in this town.
Yeah.
There's a lot of great work being done. Your program is fantastic. And
that's going to get you nowhere.
Well, but it's the truth. And so the thing wasn't, you know, we're not out to try to supplant anybody. We don't think that people are going to stop reading the DNC or somebody else and read the Beacon only. What we're trying to do is expand coverage of what we think are some of the most important issues and really look in depth and also try to drive the conversation toward constructive solutions. So we just felt that there was an opportunity to do this. But yeah, I mean, it's a difficult. The media landscape is the environment is very difficult these days. And there's a lot of talk about being digital first, and yet among legacy publications, newspapers, magazines, very few of them could live if they were digital only. Mm-hmm. So part of what we want to do is also try to explore and hopefully help build a sustainable model for digital journalism at the local level, because I think it's going to be really important in the future.
Listeners, we'll talk about what the Rochester Beacon, rochesterbeacon.com, is doing with their initial slate of stories and some of the stories they're choosing to cover, the way that they are sort of going about that process and the editorial decisions. And Smriti, it's a wide, it's sort of a wide range of possibilities. We'll talk in a minute about everything from Parcel 5 to RIP Obamacare to private practice medicine, and there's a wide range here. How do you start to go about that process of saying, well, we've got a limited staff and we're new, but this is what we want to do. This is what we want to cover.
Well, when we planned this, we sort of decided we'd think it through and take a look at what we thought were some of the complex issues in Rochester or people were talking about. And those were some of the ideas that bubbled to the surface. And I don't think that you have to look very far to see that they are on people's minds. What we are trying to do at the Beacon is sort of peel back the onion, take a deeper look, an in-depth look. But at the end of the day, I think what we offer at the Beacon is informed opinion in a community voice piece. Like if a member of the community is writing to us on any subject that they see deserves attention, that it's fact-based. And you'll find that from our writers, too, that we will approach every story looking at taking it a step further and looking deeper. And so whether it's healthcare or whether it's innovation, education, yes, it is a broad spectrum. And most of what we write really will be subjective. We understand and recognize that journalistic objectivity is kind of unattainable in a way. So we will be trying to have personal connections where appropriate to a story. For example, I'm in a story that's coming up is my journey as an immigrant. And immigration is an issue that's riveted the nation. And I detail how I came to this country and hopefully through that see where the immigration system is broken and how I navigated through that. There are other pieces that are coming up that will also take a look in that way. But it's all based on facts and numbers and information that you can count on and make decisions accordingly. So hopefully what we're trying to do, we really do, is drive public action. And which is why I got involved, is the ability to help Rochester, mm-hmm. which is my home now, and also write pieces that I couldn't write at the paper as much as I wanted to.
All right. And Kent Garner, as the opinion editor, what is the goal of an opinion, I guess I was going to say a section, but essentially a section, for a publication like this? What do you want to bring to this publication?
Well, I think we think that the the real estate for people to express their concerns about issues of significance for the community is too small, and so there are issues that I often run into people in the community who say, well, you know, this is something I'd really like to write about, but I don't really know where I could place it. Where can I express my opinion in a way that, you know, people would pay some attention? So we're trying to build a public square, build a kind of a community water cooler around important issues. And for example, this week, I mean, just before your show started, NPR was talking about the Janus decision governing public employees' unions. Well, we this week are also going to be talking about the Janus decision. I'm doing a statistical piece on the trends in unionization, and then we have two opinion pieces submitted by people with different perspectives. Adam Urbanski from the Rochester Teachers Association, and then Ken Girardin from the Empire Center for State Policy, with different perspectives on the impact of the Janus decision. So we think there's a great need for that. And, you know, so that's a task I've taken on. I'm you know, reaching out to people and soliciting pieces from people we know are responsible voices, and also asking people who have interest in expressing their positions on important issues to confront us.
All right, it's rochesterbeacon.com. Official launch date was when, Alex?
It was Thursday.
On Thursday. So let me just ask some sort of nuts and bolts questions, and then we'll get into some the meat of some of the initial writing. I see the phone ringing. Listeners, if you've got questions or comments about this new digital publication, it's not print, it's digital. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. How many people on staff at the Beacon, Alex?
So there are seven people right now.
Seven people. And your print, your publication schedule, I know, look at that. Your publication schedule is going to be how often?
So each week we're going to have each weekday in reality we're having at least one new piece that's going to be published. So there's something new to read every day. We are also going to have a weekly schedule where we basically combine the work that we do each week and send things out to people as well, so they could either read it kind of on their own or read it as they get emails if they wish to each week.
Are you paying your staff?
Not yet. We do plan to be. certainly our expectation is that we will be focusing our finances quite a bit on and making sure that what we're paying for mainly is not so much paper, et cetera, but it's going to be we're going to be paying for actual journalism. And so, you know, right now we have a 3-year plan that we've put together. But what's really kind of, you know, I think special and unique about what we're doing is that our goal is to be we're a nonprofit. Our goal is to be here for the long term. Our goal is to make sure that we are going to be putting out there for many, many years to come, things that are useful for this community in terms of being a public square, et cetera. And so from our perspective, we're certainly going to keep working every year to make sure that we have the financial wherewithal to be able to keep running this newspaper for many years to come.
Alex, I don't know if your financial analysts and advisors have told you that a good way to lose a lot of money is to start a restaurant or maybe to start a newspaper. I want to ask you about the model, because we talked about De Correspondent, which our guests have informed me is successful enough that there's an American version coming. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right? So, you know, roughly $60 a year, which I'm more than happy to pay for good journalism. Eventually, is this the kind of model you can envision here? What is the long term? A year from now, the Beacon is going to be online subscription only. It's not. I mean, how do you view it?
So our goal is at this stage is not to try to limit the actual journalism itself. I mean, we want what we put out there to get as much readership as possible. Our goal is to have a subscription. But the subscription does not necessarily limit you to what it is that you can read. However, we do think that people are interested in actually being able to do other things. So, for instance, one of the things that we're working on right now is that we want to have several in-person events every year where we are actually having people who are community thinkers, economists, etc., speaking to people. In other words, we want to also do what we do in a real-life environment and not only in an online environment. So that's, for instance, one of the things that people who are part of this journey with us, they're going to have access to things like that.
I don't fully understand, though, a subscription that doesn't impact what you can or can't read.
I think it's probably better to think of it as a membership model, which listeners to WXXI are very familiar with.
Well, sure.
I think the correspondent is an interesting case to look at, both because of the success of it, but it's actually a for-profit, but they use a membership model as well. In other words, the site is open, but they ask people to contribute a certain amount. And I think, you know, certainly in our near-term thinking, that's the kind of model that we're thinking about. We don't have, we haven't had any discussion about closing down our site in any fashion, having a paywall. Mm-hmm. But yes, we're a nonprofit, and we did a lot of thinking about that, whether we should pursue this as a for-profit, a nonprofit, a B Corp. You know, there are a lot of different ways of doing it, but we chose nonprofit for a variety of reasons, and among them was it was the best way to really build a broad community-based publication. We don't want to be closing doors to people. We want to be opening them to allow as much participation as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that does sound a little bit like a WXXI model, to be honest, Paul. I mean, and we just had our fall membership campaign. Listeners, by the way, I'm instructed to tell you, and I'm really grateful to tell you, that we exceeded our goal for the week, and thank you for that. And, yeah, in many ways, that's the model that I think is the most sustainable for journalism into the future, to let people know if you want this, you can keep it. If you're not willing to, you won't keep it.
One of the reasons we opted to go that route is because there is really a movement in that direction. We're an associate member of INN, the Institute for Nonprofit News, which now has closing in on 200 different members, including ProPublica. And there are a lot of resources that we can get from INN, but it's just there's a recognition that if you're going to build a sustainable model and something that is going to last, that the nonprofit model is one that makes a lot of sense.
All right, it's RochesterBeacon.com, and some of the people behind this publication, this digital publication, are here with us. It launched on Thursday. Let me get, before we get to your phone calls, Gary writes to the program and says, so much of media is dumbed down. Could your guests say what intellectual level the Beacon is aimed at? Who wants to take that? Okay, opinion editor, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, clearly we're tackling issues that are complicated. You can't talk about, for example, the Janus Supreme Court decision governing public union dues and agency fees. I mean, that's not a subject that, generally I talk to people without some understanding of how public policy works. So I think it's inevitable that we're going to be, aiming at people who want to be informed about some of the complex issues. And that's the kind of coverage we think is critically important. So we're not going to be, we're not going to be covering immediate news. We're not going to focus on fires. We're not going to pay much attention to the crime rate, except in as much as it might rise to the level of policing, the structure of policing, who controls, things like the Citizens Review Board. I mean, these are issues that, that we have struggled with for all the time I've been at the Center for Government Research. So I think that, these are again, they're not issues that, people would come to without any understanding.
Okay. And what is, Alex, when you think as publisher of what this can do for the community, I don't think what Kent just described excludes anybody. Anybody can read and try to digest, sort of denser information. But do you go into this thinking that this is aimed at any one particular sort of sector? Is this sort of a cousin of the Rochester Business Journal, given that some of the roots of the people who are involved? Is it not? How do you view it in those terms?
Can I jump back just for a second? I mean, I think it's incumbent upon us to write in a way that is accessible, to give people sufficient background so that they understand what the issues are in these two comment pieces on the Janus decision, for example, are preceded by three paragraphs that describe what the Janus decision entailed, talks a little bit about what an agency fee is. So we're really trying to bring people up to speed on some of these issues as well. I mean, if we're writing something where people have to come to the issue already understanding half of it, then we've really failed.
Okay. Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think that certainly there are all sorts of players in the community that do a good job of making sure that news is covered in a good way. And so I think from our perspective, what we're trying to do is really add something to the community, not necessarily saying that we're the only ones that are getting it right or plan to get it right. I think part of though the issue though is that there are plenty of business models that are kind of come back from a long way, where you need to get a certain number of articles out each day, mm-hmm. or let's say that it's television news, for instance, and there's a certain formula that goes into how a particular story needs to be covered in order to make it exciting, emotional, etc. And it's not that those things don't have their own place, but I think it's tragic on some level to have that be the only news. And I think part of what we're all trying to do and hope to do is to be able to put something out there that really does represent news that's serious, that's not purely kind of getting people to react in emotional ways, but to really think about deep issues at a local level in a way that helps everybody.
All right, let me grab a phone call. Keith in Pittsford first on the phone. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, how are you doing?
Good.
What started out as one comment has blown to four because now I'm in Tony Axel. But are you guys going to do any investigative type of journalism? That's one question. Kent mentioned community. How are you going to define community? Is it just basic Rochester, Monroe County? Are you going to use the greater Rochester area or the Finger Lakes area? I believe you should have unlimited access. So I give you my $60. I can have access to every area, because once you limit certain areas, then you're going to decide, okay, who goes there, how much? I just think it creates too many problems. And will people be able to submit anything sort of like freelance cartoon editorial?
Okay.
I think that would be interesting to see what people can come up with locally.
All right, Keith, thank you. Yeah, thanks, Keith. I appreciate that. I'm going to work backwards just in terms of what the community can contribute. I've already seen that there are some comments. In fact, we're going to talk in our second half hour about some of the specific pieces that the Rochester Beacon has already written. And Paul on Parcel 5 has gotten a number of comments, et cetera. So there is a desire to engage with the community and
absolutely.
Allow the community to be
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely, yeah. And it works on a couple different levels. One is commenting on pieces that we've published, whether they're staff written or op-eds. The other, which Kent is heading up, is actively going after and trying to get people to contribute pieces. But we welcome, and Smriti can talk mm-hmm. about this more, we welcome both op-ed type opinion pieces, ideas for things that we might pursue. To the first part of his question, will we do investigative work? That's certainly part of what we hope to do. Obviously in the early going, with somewhat limited resources, we have to pick and choose what we're going to pursue. But there isn't any story or idea that is sort of, out of the bounds of what we want to do, as long as it fits into our mission, which is trying to look at the really important issues in town and drive conversations about solutions.
Okay. Smriti, you want to take that as well?
Sure. Yes, absolutely. We want people to give us ideas and tell us what we should be writing about and why. Can I give a plug here and
sure.
say news@rochesterbeacon.com to
sure.
send your ideas? And if you'd like to write for us and submit a piece as a writer yourself, again, news@rochesterbeacon.com. And absolutely, we're open to ideas, why they should be written. And as Paul said, as long as it fits with our mission, we are very focused on looking at challenges in the area and supported by facts.
Okay. And Kent, how would you answer his question about community? He said you mentioned the word community. He wants to know how that is defined by the Rochester Beacon.
Yeah, Keith, I don't think we need to narrow that too much. I think that we'll see how that evolves. We're certainly interested in issues that have broad relevance. So I suppose if we have someone submits an issue that's very specific to an individual municipality, you know, that's perhaps out on the fringes of the metro area, we might choose not to run that. But to the extent that we're engaging issues that matter to a broad cross-section of people who live in Rochester's metropolitan area, you know, I don't think we need to define that too much.
Martin emails the program and says, "Here's the only thing that matters for me. Are the writers on your program willing to offend the powerful and or reveal information about the powerful that the powerful will not want revealed? If the answer is yes, they may get my money after all." That's from Martin. Will you offend the powerful, Kent Gardner?
Oh, well, I really hesitate to offend, as you know, Evan. So
it's not what he wants
to
hear.
Yeah, we're really going to restrict our comments. No, it's one of the fabulous opportunities that I think we all see is that it is important that that we speak truth to power, that we talk about issues that make people uncomfortable. And sometimes those are going to be unpopular, not just with the powerful, but with the readers. And that's a risk that we'll certainly take.
Okay. Paul, you hit that as well here, the importance of being willing to do that as a journalist?
Yeah, I think that is crucial. And one thing I probably should say is we are nonpartisan, non-ideological, especially in Kent's area in terms of welcoming contributed pieces. We not only welcome, but we will be reaching out and trying to get the broad spectrum of different points of view. But in terms of what we do, we just want to pursue the truth and really examine these issues closely. And if that bothers someone, so be it.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's fair enough. You know, Martin, I appreciate the email. There are political leaders in our area who will not come on this program. Some pretty much ever. Governor, I'm still waiting for your call. Some who won't come back after experiences. And, you know, as a journalist, you try to do your job. And if the powerful doesn't want to sort of engage, that is up to them. And then readers or listeners will have to decide what to make of that. But we will be reading. And I think Martin's question is a fair one. When it comes to welcoming different opinions, just to follow up on Paul's point, there is a kind of a debate or even a lampooning of both sidesism, you know, this notion that we have to be so careful to get all points of view that, yes, we're going to do a piece on immigration, but, you know, I'm sure you're also going to make sure white nationalists get their point of view out there, too. I mean, there's lines you have to draw, right, Smithy? And so eventually you can't have every single view on every single issue because some, I think you have to sort of make a values judgment, are either less important or even potentially harmful. And is that also fair to say?
Sure, but if we could go back a little bit, in the sense, if somebody is trying to make an argument or state their case, I would like to see how they came to that argument, with what facts.
Yeah, that's,
and
that's
what,
good.
So if it's just a rant, then no, yes, you're right there, then I'm inclined to say no. But if they, if it's supported by facts and evidence, I'd take a second look.
But Evan, you know, I think you allude to the tendency for some media outlets to make sure that they have balanced perspective. So if you've got 99 people on one side of an issue and one person on the other side of the issue, they want to make sure that one person gets represented. Well, that's kind of nuts, at least in my view. That if 99% of the informed individuals have a particular perspective, I think we're kind of willing to take that as consensus.
Yeah, but let me also, because the easy one to point to is, well, cable news for years had pro-vaccine and anti-vaccine folks on.
Oh, Lord, yes.
You know, and so obviously that's an easy one to kind of target, but I'll give you one that will probably come up. For a number of different reasons, reducing tax burden on Western New Yorkers in particular is probably a good idea for, you know, you want people to move here, you want people to have more of their disposable income, you want that to circulate in the economy. So you can make a lot of good arguments, I think, in many different ways for tax cuts on different levels. What you really can't say is that cutting taxes magically increases revenue. And yet, We not only hear that all the time, we see it published in op-eds, we see the New York Times publish it. Mitch McConnell was telling everybody that the recent Republican tax bill was going to be revenue neutral or better. Now we're hearing we have a nearly $1 trillion deficit, and we're reminded that Republicans only care about the deficit if Democrats are in office. And again, I'm just observing historical trends. I'm not trying to be partisan here, because there are good reasons to cut taxes. But if you're the opinion editor and I send you a piece saying our tax cuts are going to increase revenues, you know, are you going to say, okay, I'm going to publish that? Are you going to say, can you give me some documentation here?
Yeah, exactly. And that's precisely the point. And, you know, I mean, that particular issue, you pick on one that I end up having done, you know, knowing a fair bit about and talking a fair bit about. And, you know, there is a range of tax rates where that magical thing can happen where you can cut rates and actually increase revenue.
Oh, I'm sure. But if you've got a 95% top marginal tax rate, I'm sure cutting taxes would actually increase.
Yeah, actually go back to the Reagan tax cuts. I mean, the marginal tax rate was really quite high, and the Reagan tax cuts, I think, arguably really had that effect. Same thing for the Kennedy tax cuts in 1964. That was something that Kennedy pushed and Johnson pushed through after Kennedy's death. I mean, there are times when that matters, but most of the time, you know, arithmetic still counts, that if you've got lower rates, you're going to get less revenue. And so I think it's really important, again, to inform people about the complexity of issues. We live in a really messy world. And I think to pretend that the answers are simple would also be not really doing a service to the readers.
All right. And as a taxpayer myself, listeners, don't be deceived into thinking I'm not a fan of lower taxes. I'm just saying there's different arguments to be made. And you pound your head against the wall when you see the same argument that on bad evidence. So anyway.
That's right. And you know, you can't reduce tax. There's a point at which obviously reducing taxes brings revenue to zero. So anyway, yeah, it's these are complex issues, and I think we're committed to attempting to put perspective on perhaps some extreme viewpoints. So, you know, whether we publish an opinion piece that's submitted to us that takes a position that doesn't seem to be supported, I think that's we're on pretty safe ground. But if we're publishing a piece, if we're asked to publish a piece that takes a position but, as Smriti suggests, isn't well supported, we will push back.
Okay, it's rochesterbeacon.com. Let me grab one more phone call, and this comes from Ed in Rochester. Go ahead, Ed.
Hello. I appreciate your show, and I know Mr. Gardner from another setting. So, but I had two questions that have come up as I've listened. One is, how will you vet people who want to be contributors? Seven people probably aren't going to put out enough content over the long haul. So do you have to have a journalism degree?
Ed, what's enough? When you say enough content over the long haul, I'm not sure why seven people couldn't put out. I just don't. How do you define enough?
I would define enough as being, let's say you, so in the newspaper business, you might have an international stringer who is reporting on, let's say, American-influenced issues internationally, but from an international perspective. They have to be located where they're getting the local perspective on American issues. That's one question. So how are you vet people, or is this seven people it and no one else is in except opinion pieces. Second question is, how are you going to fight the fake news accusations that are polluting the discourse right now? Those are really my two, you know, how do you interview, bring people on, say, okay, this is somebody we want to be a regular contributor, and how do you fight the fake news? Oh, well, they're just making that story up. That's not actually true. Here's another version.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough.
Those two things.
Ed, thank you for the phone call. And again, his phone call, if you're just joining us, are questions for the staff members, the publisher, the editor-in-chief, the managing editor, and the opinion editor from the new Rochester Beacon, a digital publication that launched Thursday, are all here. I happen to think seven people is actually quite a robust staff that can do quite a lot, but he's asking about sort of vetting or how you're going to decide who's going to contribute.
I think one thing, it might be useful to think, you know, we started out talking about the print world, if you want to use the analogy, it might be closer to thinking about magazines versus newspapers. And think about, you know, something like The Atlantic in particular, not only in terms of the general thrust of what we're trying to do, but also in terms of the staffing. Magazines typically have a smaller staff and reach out to a number of contributors, freelance writers, and such. And, you know, we obviously, this is just a starting point. We want to scale up, and that's why we're going to need community support and donations to help us do it. But even with the people that we have, who collectively have well over a century's worth of journalism experience, we can, you know, field a lot of articles and both write them ourselves, work with freelance writers, take in contributed material from, you know, op-ed writers and such. We can really scale up, I think, fairly quickly. So, and do it in the way that we need to in order to vet the material that's being submitted to us, to fact check it, to make sure that it is. This is why we talk about not just opinion, but opinion grounded in facts, informed opinion. Anything that we publish, we're fine with opinion, but it needs to be grounded in solid information.
Okay.
Yeah, give you an example. I'm just finishing a piece this morning that's going to run in a couple of weeks, and it is replete with links, because links bring you to authoritative sources. So if you're going to cite a statistic, well, let's find out where the statistic came from. So if someone gives us a piece, whether it's someone who writes a piece for us and simply cites a statistic without giving a source, you know, we're probably not going to regard that individual as a credible contributor. So we, you know, we'll just – and that's, of course, the second half of his question is, how do you deal with fake news? Well, you give them authentic news, and you give them authentic news that is well-supported.
Okay. Let's talk about some of the pieces that have already been published in the Rochester Beacon. And, Paul, can I start with something that you wrote on Parcel 5?
Sure.
Parcel 5 has, of course, been a very hot issue in the community. And you made the case that it's impossible at this stage to know what's going to happen with that piece of land, and that you wouldn't bet a penny of the $25 million pledged by Tom Golisano for an art center as to what it is going to be. Now, for obvious reasons, the art center is still quite an open question, and council may have some decisions to make pretty soon about whether we're going back to square one. But you don't think it's going to be open space, even though you think there's a good argument for that, but you didn't just say that it would be sort of cool or fun or interesting. You pointed to a number of places, including Columbus, Ohio. Tell me a little bit about them.
Well, this is something, you know, I used to, my office at the Business Journal used to look out over Parcel 5. So for all sorts of reasons, it's been a subject of interest to me. And, you know, lots has been written and said. You've done programs. There's been a lot of conversation about Parcel 5. But I think this is an example of the type of piece that we will run quite often, which is, you know, if we're talking about issues that are some of the biggest things in the community, some of the most important issues, it's not like they've never been covered before, but we try to approach it with a fresh angle. And my particular angle was that this idea that open space is sort of dead space. It's a wasted opportunity that in terms of economic development or business development, it's just a waste.
Forfeits tax revenue.
Right, yeah. Right. And the argument that I want to explore, or the idea that I want to explore, is that actually open space, if done right, is an economic catalyst. So I looked at a number of places where this has happened: Columbus, Ohio, Bryant Park in New York City. I've been to all these places, and there's a very solid case to be made that you can actually make this into a great catalyst for economic development. Again, not just, you know, a field of grass, but something that is well-designed, well-programmed, really well thought out, and supported by the stakeholders, the property owners who surround it, because they're the ones who immediately benefit if there is, you know, a surge in activity. So that's really the point that I was trying to make or explore in that piece.
Now, eventually, do you expect to, on pieces like that, hear from City Hall? Do you decide that what you want to do is put together your own, essentially an argument, a point of view, put it out there? Do you reach out to City Hall in advance? I mean, what kind of dialogue do you expect to have in the future on pieces like that?
Well, you know, I think we have to grow our audience and maybe sure. our influence a little bit before we can expect that. But I would hope so. I mean, I would, you know, part of what we want to do is get just the conversation going. So whether they reach out to us or maybe just open up a bit to the ideas, you know, that's part of what we're trying to do. I think another aspect of what we're trying to do is avoid the tendency that often happens in journalism is you do a story on a particular topic, and that's it. And it's sort of like, well, we covered that. And so it doesn't get written about or looked at anymore. And we're trying to provide ongoing coverage of important issues. If it's important enough to write about once and it's an ongoing issue, it's important enough to keep examining. So I think Parcel 5 is an example of something that this isn't the only thing we're going to write about it.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what Kent Gardner wrote about Obamacare. You wrote "R.I.P. Obamacare" was your headline. Did I miss the funeral?
It's a sad event. I think, you know, I think that the Affordable Care Act was an attempt to move the country towards universal health care, and that's not the same thing as single payer health care. That's another and also controversial question. And what I struggled with in this piece was confronting the fact that the goals of the original Affordable Care Act had not been achieved, partly out of bad design. There were some aspects to the Affordable Care Act that were improperly drafted. Possibly they were improperly drafted because you know, that something would be better drafted wouldn't have passed. And then at the same time, you know, there's a certain death by a thousand cuts phenomenon. So we had a very complex piece of legislation that emerged as a newborn and badly needed care and feeding. And instead of getting care and feeding and getting the attention it needed to be able to grow into a real adult, you know, we kind of abandoned the thing on the street corner. And unfortunately, I'm coming to the conclusion that for many people, that we've ended up with a healthcare system that is actually worse than what we started with before the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. And so your goal is for readers to emerge with at least better information as they form opinions about something that, frankly, I think in this country you have to have an opinion about the Affordable Care Act, whether you know anything about it or not.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, our votes matter, and the conversation, I'm afraid, is splintering in some really unfortunate ways. You know, in between the at the one extreme, a Medicare for all single payer model, to a you know, let's just get rid of all these regulations and let the market work. Neither of which is an alternative, I think, that's viable politically or perhaps even viable in the market.
All right, Harry wants to know if the Beacon's going to seek ads. All right, publisher Alex Zabistoshny.
Sure. So we're not going to have ads in the traditional sense. Actually, I'll use WXXI as another good model, or PBS as a good model, where we certainly could or would put forward advertisement of sorts, but more in a kind of nuanced, subtle way, for instance, at the beginning of a PBS show, you see that kind of advertising
sure.
happening. So from that perspective, yes.
Okay. And he says, good luck. He also wants to know, do you guys have an office address? Do you exist anywhere?
We exist everywhere.
You're ever present everywhere. It is online, by the way. Harry was looking for it online. Online, rochesterbeacon.com.
Rochesterbeacon.com.
Rochesterbeacon.com. Mary in Spencerport is next on the phone. Go ahead, Mary.
I have a request that this newspaper that they consider refraining from using terminology that makes everything a war or a conflict or a fight. I think that it uses those terminologies encourages the us versus them and discourages lively discussion and difference of opinion and working together.
So war and sort of violent terminology and right. vocabulary to describe everything, especially.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. It's an interesting point. I'll turn to the managing editor for some thoughts on that. What do you think, Smriti?
Well, it's certainly not us versus them. Mm-hmm. The way I see the Beacon is we're all in this together, and we're just trying to highlight issues that need attention and need explanation and trying to get at the heart of it and at the truth. no war, no conflict. This is our city. This is our region. And we all have a stake in it.
Mary, but I actually think that that's a very important point that the caller brought up.
Okay.
Because part of what we want to do, and when we talk about the idea of making sure that the things that we're putting out there, that things have a factual basis, that we're trying to make sure that people actually are reading kind of the facts and not just trying to be inflamed by a particular phrasing. I mean, I think all of us certainly in this room agree that a big part of our goal and a part of what we can do to help our community is to not kind of go for the easy thing of just trying to inflame people, but actually to try to be as factual as possible in whatever it is that we're trying to communicate. So I think for all of us, that is a key point.
All right. One of our listeners is asking if the Beacon is going to attempt to break news, so not cover breaking news. As Kent said earlier, you're not going to be covering house fires and car accidents, but whether the Rochester Beacon will attempt to break news, to publish information that the public does not know, to sort of shape public conversation on issues. And that's an interesting question. Is the Beacon going to try to break news?
Go ahead.
They're all looking at each other saying, I'm very curious how you're going to answer this.
I was going to say that, you know, as a longtime journalist, it would be hard to say no to that question. Sure, we'll try to break news, but again, we are not going to be chasing breaking news on a day-to-day basis. So the type of stories that hopefully will break will be ones that we've spent weeks, if not longer, researching and reporting to make sure that we get all the facts and really have an in-depth look at whatever it is. But it may be something that people haven't heard about before.
Okay. And, you know, just as an example, when we have covered Parcel 5 earlier this year, WXXI and in particular producer Megan Mack and I took us a number of days to get enough sourcing on the record to break the story that there was an attempt underway to get essentially replacement developers lined up if the Bob Morgan situation plays out in a direction that would make him unable and his firm unable to participate. And it looked kind of like a Hail Mary pass. Doesn't mean it won't happen or it's impossible, but that was a fascinating development. Pretty hard to pin down the sourcing, but we were able to do it. And it sounds like that's the kind of stuff that could happen with the Beacon. I mean, you all know a lot of people in this town.
Sure.
You have a lot of sources. I mean, Smriti, there's no – I mean, you've got an RMAPI story coming here. I don't know what you're breaking on RMAPI. We'll talk about – I'd love to talk to you about how you view approaching reporting on the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. What's the goal of a piece on that?
Well, I think people want answers on RMAPI. I think people are curious as to how we are grading it, what metrics they use to sort of to measure their success. And my piece that comes out this week takes a look at not just that, just how RMAPI views itself. I think what I found was a disconnect between how RMAPI views itself and how the community views RMAPI. So that's what the story will look at.
How would you describe that? And again, it's never fun to ask to dumb down a piece that when the whole purpose of the Rochester Beacon is to respect the reader and respect depth. But how would you sort of distill that disconnect between the way the community views the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative and how the initiative may view itself?
I think that the community looks at it as a grant-making organization, that they received a lot of money that they have been slow to dole out, and that they're sitting on all this funds that have come from the state and haven't done anything with it. RMAPI would say that they're not a grant-making organization. Mm-hmm. They're an initiative, and an initiative that's owned by the community. And that's what does that really mean is what my story takes a look at. Like, what does it mean? You're asking me to give everything away.
I know. So when's the story publishing?
Thursday.
On Thursday. Are you going to tell us who's right? Which perception is more right? Than?
Wait and see.
Okay, Thursday. And the piece is on the Rochester Monroe Anti-Poverty Initiative. You've got a piece, Alex, you got a piece on STEM grads coming up?
That was posted today.
Oh, that's up now.
That was posted today. Actually, the background data behind that came from the Center for Governmental Research, and it's interesting because this information has been out there. And I, actually, Kent and I both sit on a the life sciences initiative that was kind of looking at some of these statistics. And what was really fascinating is when I saw that we were submitting something to the state that said that we in Rochester have more STEM grads per capita than any other place of a million or more people in the country, it really kind of hit me as a pretty big shock. And so I went and I looked at the Center for Governmental Research, trying to understand kind of, you know, does this really say what I'm hoping it says? And it does. And not only that, but for arts degrees, we're also number two in the country. And if you look at the combination of us being number one in STEM and number one in arts, I mean, we have a truly amazing kind of replenishment that happens of each year as these new STEM and arts degrees individuals graduate. So from my perspective, and maybe this also goes back to something a little bit earlier in the conversation, sometimes it's better to have fewer facts, but really to emphasize it so everybody knows them, because this is a sort of thing that all of us should take such pride in in Rochester. And from my perspective, even though apparently, you know, this stat's been around for a while, I think all of us should be saying it because it means so much to individuals who are thinking about Rochester, whether to go to school here, to hopefully stay here after their schooling is done. But yes, I mean, I'm personally very proud of us as a city.
All right. In the last 20 seconds, as the music starts, Paul, since this whole thing is your fault, the Rochester Beacon, if this is a successful first year, you'll be able to look back and say, what about the Beacon?
Certainly that we've grown our audience, but really more that we've made an impact on the community, that hopefully in several cases we've moved the conversation and helped create some solutions on some of the big challenges that we're facing.
RochesterBeacon.com, congratulations on week one, and thanks for taking the time to be here. Listeners, it's going to be publishing, again, with this staff of at least seven and with a number of opinion contributors on a wide range of issues, publishing each week. So RochesterBeacon.com, digital only, and I look forward to the next conversation. I think a lot of journalists in this town are very curious to see where you go. So thank you for all being here, and please keep us abreast of what's happening there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
The Rochester Beacon. Short break. More connections coming up.